everybody. Welcome back to the Damage Report. It is Friday. Thank God. I'm John Adirola. Hey, Brett, how's it going? Brett Ehrlich, host of Happy Half Hour. When it existed.
It's coming back. We've been on hiatus. Some shows take a break because they got too drunk for too many months in a row and their liver needs time to breathe.
And so Common Room will be coming back.
Common Room. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm really stressed out.
Yeah. I'm here to tell you, it's only the country that's going in the wrong direction, not you.
Okay. It's just everything, not me.
It is
okay,
not
that's good.
You.
That's good. So look, the news isn't particularly stressful today. We've got some fun stories. We're gonna be joking around. Let's see. Tucker Carlson has identified the biggest issue in science these days, feminists somehow. So we're gonna be talking about that. Fox News decided to do one of their diner interviews and it didn't quite work out the way that they planned. Donald Trump's Nobel Peace Prize aspirations encountered a bit of a setback yesterday. We'll be breaking down exactly how that worked. And perhaps more importantly, we've got two awesome guests who are gonna be joining us throughout the show. In just a little bit, Representative Jamie Raskin is gonna be joining us to talk about prescription drug prices, reform to health insurance, and a little bit about the dialogue happening inside of the Democratic Party around Medicare for All, single payer, and all of that. Later on, William Davies has written a book, Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason, which is everywhere that I am right now. And it's basically about the loss of respect for expertise, logic, facts, and all of that, with a healthy dose of Donald Trump woven throughout it, but a lot of historical analysis as well. So that should be a lot of fun too. By the way, I didn't ask you, how are you doing?
Doesn't matter.
No? Okay, good.
No one cares.
I care.
I'm fine then. Oh, I'm glad you asked.
That's good. That's good.
I've been walking in the mornings.
Yeah. Been exercising is important.
Yeah.
Some wellness.
But it's turning me into a bad person.
Why?
Because like I'm at that point where my body's still sore. Mm-hmm. So yeah, at the first day I had more energy. Now that energy has turned into just genuine general discomfort, and I'm taking it out on literally everyone I know.
You know, I've noticed. Like, so I've been trying recently to exercise a lot, like every morning, and when you do that, you're just sore all the time.
Yeah.
So you never feel like, oh, I'm in better shape than I was. Mm-hmm. I always feel like I could die at any moment.
Yeah.
What's the point of exercising?
So you can tweet hashtag.
I don't understand, really.
It's so you can tweet hashtag no days off.
Yeah, maybe.
That's it.
Did not know that was a hashtag. You're sore all the time and weaker because of how sore you are. You're weaker than you would be if you didn't lift weights at all.
Yeah.
I don't understand the world. No, I don't.
You look
Thank you.
Hashtag no. John looks swole.
I think it's just that I'm still bright red from sunburn. I think that's what it is, but thank you. And by the way, I am peeling. I'm peeling. We're
Sergio.
Finding new layers, not of American politics, but of my epidermis. Anyway, let's jump into the news because there's
right, that.
That
is enough talk of that.
That's, you, no, you want.
No, I'm done.
Do you want me to describe it? I have analogies.
Please don't.
Okay, so let's talk about the news. Let's jump to, hey everybody. Bernie Sanders was on The Daily Show, and overall it was a fine interview. It was perfectly fine, but Trevor Noah did raise a couple of questions that I found to be interesting, and I wanted to debate the question and the response with you, Brett. So the first had to do with the upcoming town hall that Bernie Sanders is gonna be doing on Fox News. So Trevor Noah said, you've decided to do, by the way, we would love to show you the footage, but I don't wanna lose my entire career and they're litigious. You've decided to do a Fox News town hall, even though the DNC made a decision not to go with Fox News for any of the debates. You're breaking with that line of thinking. Some would say, but Bernie, why would you go to Fox News? It's not a legitimate news organization. So what are you doing there? And Bernie responded, trust me, I know Fox News. I know who they are and I know the role they are playing. So to me, it's important to distinguish Fox News from the many millions of people who watch Fox News. And it's important to talk to those people and say, you know what? Many of you voted for Donald Trump and he lied to you. And it's interesting, so Trevor Noah is asking the question, but I've seen many people, generally not fans of Bernie Sanders, saying, why is he doing this? Why is he legitimizing Fox News? What do you think?
I mean, you can't legitimize or delegitimize something so ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. Like, it's there, it is Fox News. It is mostly, I think he would be judged after this more on his like swagger going into it or coming out of it than he will be by whether he did Fox News. I think that's become more of the rubric by which you judge people. Like Bernie Sanders, if he went in and he was like, yes, I want to, maybe I shouldn't, oh, I'm doing what the DCCC or the DNC says is a good thing, like when it, or DNC says when it comes to whether we'll have an actual sanctioned DNC debate on Fox News. Mm-hmm. I think this is this should play to Bernie's strengths to just go into a what's considered a hostile environment and go like, you want a job? Don't you want a job? Here, let me just talk to you right now, face to face, person to person. And I think his ability to do that supersedes and, you know, gets rid of any concerns you would have about him going to Fox News and that working against him. What do you think?
That was a good impersonation, by the way. One of your underrated ones.
You have to pretend you're eating a pastrami sandwich.
My wires got crossed a couple of years ago, and now when I try to do Donald Trump, I sound more like Bernie than I do like Donald Trump. Not good. So you've mostly responded to the legitimizing Fox News thing. I agree. At this point, it's not up to one person to legitimize or delegitimize it. So I think that that's a somewhat disingenuous argument that some people are making. But I think the more common thing is, why are you undercutting the DNC?
Yeah.
Why do you believe that they're so wrong in thinking that there shouldn't be a debate on Fox News? And I'm trying to be reasonable. It's literally the only thing that I'm trying to be. I don't think that this is hypocritical or undercutting the DNC. I don't think these are the same thing. I think that Bernie Sanders choosing individually for himself to go on Fox News, something he's done before, and we're gonna show you an awesome clip from a past Bernie Sanders town hall on Fox News, is very different than opening up the entire field of Democratic candidates to the selective questioning of a panel of Fox News people, where they can be sort of trying to pick winners and losers and all of that. I think that you could be concerned for Bernie that they'll be unfair to him or whatever, but I don't think that Bernie going on his own to do a town hall is going to somehow hurt the Democratic field of the Democratic Party.
Right, and the attacks Fox News has launched against Democrats lately is against their perception of what a socialist represents.
Yeah.
And so I think the person who best is able to articulate the stuff that Fox is trying to characterize as like terrible socialism, the person who's best capable of showing up and being like, here's what I believe, take it or leave it, period. This is the worst someone who represents these ideas is going to sound. Mm-hmm. No one's gonna sound more purely, you know, representing like this democratic socialist than me. I'm gonna tell you what all those positions are. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, I'm pretty sure you're gonna be like, that sounds reasonable. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, there's some historical precedent to believe that that might happen because as he pointed out in his interview with Trevor Noah, he's done this before with Bret Baier. So we have a little clip of how that played out in response to one of Bret Baier's questions.
I happen to believe, and I know not everybody agrees with me, I believe that healthcare is a right of all people. I believe that there is something wrong when we are spending—
Where did that right come from in your mind?
Being a human being, And what I believe, Brett, you may disagree with me, I believe that if she is poor and you are rich, she is entitled to the same quality health care that you have because she's a human being.
And we cut off the video because Bret Baier punched him in the face there, and we can't show that. I'm kidding. So that was a Fox News audience, mostly clapping. I do love that there were a couple of people that, if you watch that again, that weren't clapping. Like, oh, she deserves health care because she's a human. No, I don't like that. But anyway, I think that that's probably, we're gonna see quite a few moments like that.
Was that a Fox News audience? Where was that? I don't know.
I don't know exactly where it was.
So there's a Fox News audience watching the debate from home. Is there a Fox News audience in the audience?
My assumption would be that in the same way that CNN generally brings in people, I think, that are reflective of how they view politics, I would imagine that Fox would do that. I might be wrong, but Fox did put that together.
Yeah.
So I would err on that side. But anyway, as he points out, there will be millions of people on Fox News watching it. And I think that it's kind of unfair in that, look, I think that AOC is a great communicator for that as well. But they've been so poisoned against her. And there's the, you know, sort of natural racism and misogyny amongst a not insignificant chunk of that audience. But with Bernie, he can avoid a little bit of that. And he might win some people over to either his candidacy or to the philosophy.
Right, because at the very least, there will be a there will be a period of an hour when Bernie is just straight up talking to Fox News viewers. Afterward, no doubt Fox News anchors and producers will cut it up into segments and selectively present those segments as, here's what socialist Bernie said. But they're going to do that with town halls that happen on other networks anyway.
I agree. Okay, so really fast, one other question. So on his appearance on The Daily Show, Bernie Sanders was asked this question by Trevor Noah. Noah said, this is an interesting time where this field is more diverse than ever before. But some people have said, all right, you have a diverse field, but it feels like the front runners are still old white men. And Sanders said, you're not talking about me, are you? Noah said, isn't it time for you guys to step aside? Referring to him and Joe Biden. And he said, look, I think the American people have to make that decision. Nobody else makes it. But I think it is appropriate for people to say, okay, who has been talking about this issue when? Who had the courage to go forward and at what time? So it's important not to look at just personalities. I think in American politics in general, we do too much of that. And look, I agree. If a bunch of people that are voting in a Democratic primary do feel like it's time for a different sort of candidate, then that's how they'll vote. I am just 100% against any sort of shortcuts in the primary. Any belief that it won't be down to the voters, that we will tell people they need to step aside, you need to drop your candidacy because of the demographic, you know, realities of who you are.
Right.
I think that they might run up against a wall in the primaries. Any number of different candidates could. But I don't necessarily like the framing that it should be on Bernie to not run in the first place necessarily.
Yeah. And
there, I'm not necessarily just responding to Trevor Noah. Maybe I'm being a bit too hard on him, but I've seen any number of editorials implying the same exact thing.
Right. You can criticize, like, and Trevor Noah might be asking this question so that Bernie can respond to it.
It's possible.
But it's still, you can still judge an interview based on what questions they ask, even if they are couched like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that the same people that are critical of Bernie Sanders for being too old are the people who say, like, you need to find a strategically moderate window. Mm-hmm. And all of that equilibrium finding rests on like what the other guy is like, and the other guy's old.
Yeah,
so Trump, the alternative is old. You're not going to win or lose because you have two old people. Because
mm-hmm. like
that's their logic. So
yeah.
I think it would work out anyway.
And in terms of the ability of or the possible effect that age might have on the actual candidacy or the campaign, Bernie said, "All I can say is thank God my health is good. As a kid, I was a long distance runner. I had a lot of endurance, and I still do." And then he ran out of the studio straight to Iowa. No, I don't know about that.
But we didn't know. We didn't even see him leave. Afterwards, there was just like dust.
Just dust.
And you heard.
That may be a reference that some younger viewers won't get. But I grew up on that stuff. Really fast, I just want to mention, I wish I knew, who is Trevor Noah supporting right now? Assuming he's supporting a Democrat, which I assume he will. I wonder who he supports. Trevor Noah is such an interesting figure. Like, he's pissed off a lot of people over the last few years with some of his political views. It would be very interesting to get into his head and know, does he like Bernie or not? You can't always tell from the interviews.
Me neither. Yeah. We'll see.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Representative Jamie Raskin is going to join us. We're going to be talking about prescription drug prices, single-payer healthcare, and more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We Recently, healthcare has been very much back in the news, both the continuing problems of the current system and also the added damage Donald Trump seems dead set on doing to the system. And joining us now to break down the current situation and how we might fix some of the problems is Representative Jamie Raskin. Representative Raskin, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me, John.
Very glad to have you here. So I know that you've been doing a lot of talking recently about some fixes you'd like to see to the current healthcare and health insurance system. But before we get into the solutions, from your point of view, what are the biggest issues right now with healthcare access and pricing that needs to be addressed in the near future?
Well, let's see. The prescription drug prices is at the heart of it in some sense, because we've got millions of people, probably one in five or one in six prescription drug users, who are having a hard time paying for their medicine. We also have 30 or 40 million people who are simply without health insurance, and that's obviously a crisis for them and for their families. There are millions more who are underinsured, and in a sense, everybody's health insurance is shaky because the copays and the deductibles continue to go up. So we are paying the most of any wealthy country in the world for our healthcare system, but we are getting very mediocre results when you look at the rest of the world. So that's the basic problem. But the prescription drug crisis is the most urgent problem that we've got to deal with.
So I had been reading not too long ago about an event that you were holding, and you talked about prescription drug pricing and one possible solution being looking at the difference in pricing on average for certain prescription drugs between the price that's provided here in the US and what's available overseas. And that I know is also a part of, I think, Bernie Sanders' plan. So how do you go about actually getting those prices down to where they're at in other countries, like in Europe?
Well, we're going to have to come at it from a lot of different angles. One is through the Medicare system. Because of a special interest provision that was slipped into Medicare Part D, we actually have a situation where the government cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for lower prescription drug prices. We've got that power in Medicaid. We've got that power in the VA system. But solely because of this special interest rider that got snuck into the bill, the Americans are losing somewhere around $25 or $30 billion a year to jacked up prices by Big Pharma. So the first thing we need to do is to restore the power of government to negotiate for lower prescription drug prices. And if we can't arrive at a compromise figure with Big Pharma, we should have the power to go ahead and develop a patent and a license for generic drugs to be produced by other companies. So that's one big thing. But the other thing I'm very focused on is making sure that the exact same companies aren't charging our patients and consumers more for a drug than they charge for the exact same drug in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in France, in the Scandinavian countries, and so on. So, you know, this is scandalous that we have the exact same drug being sold by the exact same company at a much higher price in America than it's being sold abroad. So we want to abolish that practice and make sure that we're paying what everybody else is paying. We also think that people should be able to buy safe, affordable import drugs from Canada and from other major countries that are in competition with the American companies.
So as it stands right now, of course, the Democrats have retaken the House. The Senate is still very much controlled by the Republicans. Do you see a path forward in the next 2 years where potentially the apparent split on the philosophy on dealing with healthcare between Donald Trump and some Republicans in the House and in the Senate, is there a path where on certain of these areas that you're talking about, there might actually be able to be some progress before Democrats conceivably retake the Senate eventually down the road?
I hope so. At least rhetorically, there seems to be some grounds for hope. The president, in his last State of the Union address, came here and said he wanted to work with Democrats on lowering prescription drug prices. And you know, you think that, again, at least based on the rhetoric, that Republicans would support the idea of giving the government the power to negotiate for lower prices in market fashion with the big pharmaceutical companies. On the other hand, that shows you the difference between rhetoric about free markets and then the reality of big corporate domination of government, because obviously the Republicans are very much in the pocket of big pharma and are unlikely to want to make any changes that would cost big pharma any money.
So right now in the Democratic caucus, it seems like there's still a pretty wide range of views of what needs to be done and what needs to be prioritized on healthcare, between some who are pushing for Medicare for all or some other form of single payer, and others who believe that they should prioritize protecting the ACA and possibly expanding it. But I've noticed that over the past couple of years since the last presidential election, it seems like there has been quite a bit of movement for some of the more bold, more radical plans. We're about to enter into an even more contested Democratic primary this time around. Do you feel like within the next 2 years, the median position on healthcare reform in the Democratic caucus might significantly change by 2020?
Well, I do believe a majority of the Democratic caucus in the House is already favoring a Medicare for all plan. And I think nearly the entire caucus, if not everybody, favors the idea of getting to universal health coverage and universal health care for all American citizens. You know, and I think that's the big gulf and the big distinction between the Democrats in the House and the Republicans in the House. They just simply don't have that as a goal. They don't consider it a problem that 30 or 40 million Americans are left almost completely outside of the healthcare system. Whereas for us, we consider that a moral crisis, and we think that we need to act in order to get there. And obviously, there are 100 different ideas about how we get there, but that critical values clarification is underway. Obviously, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate are not going to move any of the plans that Democrats have put forward in order to get coverage for everybody. They're just a party of no at this point. They can't do anything other than call for the destruction of the Affordable Care Act and the throwing of 35 million people off their plans and the defense of the big prescription drug companies. But we are continuing to set forth the value that we want healthcare for everybody in the country. And we consider that a public responsibility. So the Affordable Care Act is flawed in different ways, but it's moved us at least to recognize that healthcare should be a basic right for every citizen in the country.
One final question, because you brought up the recent discussion about the Republicans possibly once again trying to eliminate the ACA, which would, as you point out, throw more than 30 million people off their health insurance. They seem to have backed up a little bit from that, but Donald Trump is saying that he's still very eager to campaign based on their healthcare plans. Considering the effect that their proposed changes would have, are you also enthusiastic about campaigning on their proposed healthcare changes?
Well, yeah, let's make no mistake about this. They have tried dozens of times to destroy the ACA and to throw tens of millions of people off their health care without any substitute proposal being on the table at all. That's their basic approach. They also filed a brief as recently as I think it was March 23rd, arguing that the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as they call it, is completely unconstitutional and should be struck down. They are at constant war with the idea that insurance companies have to cover people for pre-existing conditions. And that is probably the best philosophical crucible through which to see the division between our parties. We believe that the fact that you've got a pre-existing condition, whether it is breast cancer or colon cancer or cystic fibrosis or multiple sclerosis or malignant narcissistic personality disorder, whatever it is, the fact that you have a pre-existing condition is the reason why you need health insurance and you should not be thrown off of it. Whereas their position is, well, let the market operate. And if the insurance companies want to throw people off of their plans because of a pre-existing condition, let the market operate. And we obviously think that that's just uncivilized. And so that's a critical difference between us. And we know that we were elected in 2018 to protect pre-existing condition coverage for everybody. And we're going to continue to fight every single day to protect it against the relentless attacks by the Republicans.
Representative Jamie Raskin, once again, thank you for joining us on the show.
Totally my pleasure to be with you, John.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Welcome back, Brett.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. You want to talk about something a little bit fun, a little
bit
light?
No, that's fine.
Okay, then let's find something serious here. No, let's just keep going the way we were going to. You remember when Donald Trump was potentially going to get a Nobel Peace Prize? You laughed for something different, but that is also a funny statement. And then we found out that, actually, you know, I'll wait because you produce this. I'll wait for that. That'll be a little bit of a surprise. But so he wants a Nobel Peace Prize. I don't think he really has any sort of like vested interest in the peace part of it, but he knows that Obama for some reason got one, and so he wants one too, like a kid. And there's some bad news about that that came out last night. According to the New York Times, the committee announced that it had uncovered what appeared to be a forged nomination of President Trump for the prize. The matter has been referred to the Oslo police for investigation. Furthermore, the forgery appears to have occurred twice. The secretary of the five-member committee said it appeared that a forged nomination of Mr. Trump for the prize was also submitted last year and was also referred to the police. Now, the interesting thing, though, is not just that twice, 2 years in a row, forged nominations for Trump have been submitted. The head of the economic crime section of the Oslo police said that investigators had been in touch with the FBI since last fall, which suggests that the forged nominations originated in the United States. I bet I can guess the city and the house where they came from.
So in order to nominate someone officially for the Nobel Prize, you need to fit a certain, you know, description. And usually it's heads of state. It's like people that work for The Hague.
We can't.
You can't just do it. It's not like, you know, some random. It's not like Smirkanish can write you a recommendation or like Judge Napolitano. Like, you can't just do that. It is.
Those are the two choices.
I don't know why Smirkanish. It's my favorite name, maybe.
Yeah.
But just like, it's like a media personality. Someone from TV is like, you know what? I saw him talk about it. We should nominate him. We should do him a favor. It is like heads of state
and Beyonce.
So he is and Beyonce, and he's forging.
Well, we don't know that he is. Let's be fair.
Someone is forging like a head of state signature.
I wonder if this ties in with other news, because we found out Donald Trump had said a couple of times that Shinzo Abe had nominated him for this.
Yeah.
And then we found out an interesting wrinkle to that. It's technically true. Technically, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe nominated US President Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize last autumn after receiving a request from the US government to do so. Oh.
So
that's like if I all of a sudden had a cool nickname, and then you found out that like Brett gave me it after I requested he do so.
Yeah. Mm, can you?
That's not good.
Can you call me Pizza Man?
Call me T-Bone.
Yeah.
No, that's don't. That's not good.
But the best is the way that Trump talked about it. So the second video we have for this, so we're gonna skip the Lindsey Graham one can go back to that. But here is Trump before in the Rose Garden appearing with Shinzo Abe talking about his nomination, and he's not sure he can say it, but he's gonna say it.
I think I can say this. Prime Minister Abe of Japan gave me the most beautiful copy of a letter that he sent to the people who give out a thing called the Nobel Prize. He said, I have nominated you, or respectfully on behalf of Japan, I am asking them to give you the Nobel Peace Prize. I said, thank you. Many other people feel that way, too. I'll probably never get it, but that's okay. They gave it to Obama. He didn't even know what he got it for.
What do you think you're getting it for? You can't even finish that sentence. He gave me a copy of a letter. The original's in the Oval Office. I wrote it. It's so sad.
This is all reported. Like, Shinzo Abe has not said yes. The president asked me to do that, but it was reported in like an Asahi newspaper that like that happened. It was corroborated by Reuters. Like, that is the official position. But just rewatching that, Trump knowing that he asked this guy to do it for him, and Shinzo being like, sure, fine.
Yeah.
Here's the letter.
And we find out that some were forged. And I wonder, are we ever gonna find out where it was sent from? I mean, I'm sure even if Trump or, you know, someone in his team had done it, they wouldn't have literally mailed from the White House, right. I'm sure. But oh God, it would be great to find out.
Right, we've narrowed it down to the thousands of Trump sycophants and toadies, including Trump himself.
Yeah, the entire crew of Fox News. Okay, with that, why don't we move over to actually something related to Fox News. Fox News likes to do these interviews where they go to a diner because that's where real Americans are. I'm criticizing them, but everyone else in the media does this same thing. It's really frustrating. And they can normally expect that they're going to get a response to a question that reflects Fox News sort of ideology, but not always. And this time on climate change, they ran up against some truth.
Jack is an info specialist and he really wants Howard Schultz to talk about climate change, specifically the Green New Deal, which you support. Why do you support it?
Yeah, it's really important we keep below 2 degrees Celsius of average warming, otherwise the consequences are going to be devastating.
How do we pay for it?
Yeah, how do we pay for World War II? At the end of the day, when something is this important, our economy is going to suffer if we don't pay for it.
Okay, but you do agree with the sentiment that this is as big a deal, climate change that is, as World War II?
Yeah, I mean, a little over 400,000 Americans died in World War II and climate change killed 150,000 people per year at least.
Okay, let's talk about the money because that's a huge part of this. How are we going to pay for it?
Yeah. So during World War II, for one thing, the government just pushed some of the cash up front and raised some tax on some folks. But at the end of the day, it stimulated the economy so much that everyone benefited.
Okay, so to review, you are in favor of raising taxes in order to support the Green New Deal.
If that's the optimal solution the economists sort out, I'll go with that.
Jack, thank you for your time. And finally,
thank you for your time, and I regret this a lot.
Does he?
What? No?
Does he regret? I saw that floating around, and I was
I think I know what you're saying. He got what he wanted, raised taxes to pay for the Green New Deal. But what he didn't get was a wild-eyed hippie tree hugger. Like, that guy was very, I spend 6% of my waking moments talking about climate change, and his answers were better than mine would have been. And it sounded like he had prepared every single one of those responses. I thought he did a great job of arguing in the historical context, similar to how AOC does. He seemed very reasonable.
I will say this. Look at the guy sitting next to him. Mm-hmm. That guy is visually representing the working class. Mm-hmm. He's a guy in a vest and a hat and a flannel. And next to him is this dude in a button-down Banana Republic shirt and a fancy boy haircut. And I'm not saying that I believe this, but this is what you see when you're watching Fox News. And that person is quickly and crazily talking about this Green New Deal in World War II.
Yeah, look, I do agree, especially the fact that he's young. It'll be easy for a lot of the stereotypical 68-year-old Fox News viewers to sort of write it off. But they don't want to rely on just those people. And I think younger viewers will see that and think, he doesn't seem crazy.
But you don't know who's the Fox viewer.
I think a younger viewer, you're saying, or an average viewer?
There's no younger Fox viewer.
There's got to be some.
Yeah, but John, how many?
10%.
How many younger, 10% of the audience that's watching Fox News daytime?
The future
daytime.
Of Fox News. Oh yeah, daytime,
so
that's true.
What I'm saying is like, that doesn't exist. I think the way you get through to the Fox News viewer on the Green New Deal is you say, you know how your energy job is disappearing? Mm-hmm. We're going to give you an energy job. That's it. They're going to talk about all this other stuff, but we're just going to encourage, the way we've been encouraging coal, we're going to encourage other energy jobs.
I think you're being unfair to Jack. I think he only got to respond to the questions that they asked him. He brought up the economic stimulus.
He did fine. He is who he is. He's genuinely communicating his own ideas. I just think the messaging that works behind the Green New Deal is, listen, the original New Deal worked for people. Mm-hmm. The Green New Deal will do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we are going to back things that give you jobs. You can, climate change, you don't believe it. I don't need you to believe it. You don't need you to believe it. Mm-hmm. But you want a job, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to get you that job.
Seems reasonable. Okay, so everybody watching this, integrate his advice. Go hang out in diners, and maybe you'll get to talk to, is it Todd Pirro? And you deliver the message a little bit, a second draft, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jack 2020. Anyway, okay, so we're going to take another break. When we come back, William Davies, author of Nervous States, is going to talk about the death of reason after this. When you listen to politicians speak, when you poll the people on what they believe, it is becoming increasingly clear that facts aren't worth what they used to be, that logic is kind of an obstacle that people feel like they should just avoid at this point. And I want to understand this process better. And so I'm very excited to welcome to the show now William Davies, author of Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. William, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Very glad to have you here. So in your book, you address the sort of growing lack of respect for expertise and logic and whether a thing that someone believes is true or not. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How bad is the situation we find ourselves in?
Well, I think what I try to do is not simply to blame this situation on the presence of liars in politics. I know that there are lots of liars in politics right now. We have our own problems in Britain, and I know you have your own particularly extreme problems in the United States. What I'm trying to do partly is to look at what is the status of experts in public life and try to... Sorry, my picture. And try to understand why do we put faith in politics, in experts in the first place? And I think there are various things that have undermined the status of economists and statisticians in politics over recent years. For one thing, I think the inequality in our economy means that lots of people are having experiences that are simply not captured in headline indicators that many liberals have placed far too much trust in over recent years, such as, you know, the unemployment rate is falling, the gross domestic product is rising, and so on. But I think that, you know, we also live in a time where control over the media has obviously become far less, has really sort of fractured in the age of the internet. So conspiracy theorists and those who are spreading, you know, so-called fake news and conspiracies and so on have far more opportunities in order to undermine experts and objective facts.
I could not agree more. That has certainly been my experience. You actually begin the book with a sort of example of this overall process that you're talking about. And it starts just moments into Donald Trump's presidency. Can you describe that for us?
Well, I was interested in this whole dispute about the size of his crowd, which, I mean, it was kind of very telling in a way that, I mean, the Trump presidency began immediately with an argument about this, the size of this crowd, the number of people at his inauguration ceremony. And what I was interested in was that, first of all, you know, why did it matter to Trump so much? Well, in a sense, Trump was claiming that this was a sort of demonstration, not really of a sort of piece of factual evidence, but a sort of surge of love that he believed people had for him. And it was extremely important to him what the size of it was. But the other thing which I think interested me, and I think this tells us something about the kind of fix that politics is in right now, is that really there are no authoritative measures of crowd size. I mean, it was perfectly clear from the aerial photography and so on that it was half the size of the Obama inauguration of 2012 or whatever it might be. But we live in a time where numbers themselves no longer seem to be able to settle arguments to the same extent. I mean, we have similar problems going on in relation to Brexit right now. This idea that politicians the numbers will settle political arguments is, I think, something which is really kind of in serious trouble at the moment.
And so obviously I wish that we had time to go through it, but your book is also a sort of historical analysis of going back centuries of how we got to where we are, what sort of set the stage. One important topic, I guess, would be, do you have any advice on what we can actually do? And by that, I mean people who might be watching this video, regular people sort of existing in the American political context or in other countries, or for me as a member of the media who discusses politics and news, sure. What can we do, if anything, to fight back against this trend?
Well, one of the things that I argue in the book is that it's no good blaming people for being emotional. I mean, people have always been emotional, and politics has always been a space in which people can be partly swayed by their feelings, by sentiments, and so on. And I mean, you know, questions about propaganda and spin and so on, these are not new problems in politics. I think one of the problems we have right now is that this cycle of politics, particularly led by the media, has accelerated to the point that in some ways people have no choice but to trust their instincts a lot of the time. And I think that in some ways, you know, this is why Trump is such a kind of an appropriate politician for our times, in that he breaks through this complete blizzard of data and narrative and information the whole time, with his outrage, with his lies, whatever it might be. But he has a kind of provides a focal point for the media. And of course, I know it's easier said than done, but one of the things that I think the media needs to try and do is to kind of try to set its own pace to a greater extent and not allow itself to be constantly distracted by the latest lie, the latest scandal, and so on. And I mean, this is something that I think many journalists in the United States have been trying to say. It's a very difficult thing to do. But I think one way or another, we have to try and slow things down in the way in which we analyze things. And we also need to kind of make a virtue of the slowness of facts. One of the problems that facts have in the public domain is that facts and fact-checking is always slower than outrage and, yeah. And this era of kind of fast data streams, big data, and so on. But in some ways, I think there are domains where I think it's very interesting, where trust is very high in public life and in politics, particularly around the medical profession. If you look at surveys of trust in experts around the world, there's one type of expertise that still retains very high levels of trust, and that's doctors and nurses. People blame insurance companies, they blame policymakers, they blame journalists, that trust in all these institutions is fragmenting. But people still look to those who they think can provide a kind of careful, slow, thoughtful and sympathetic consideration of their needs. And I think that a lot of people are looking for a type of politics that potentially can put a stop to this sort of constant stream of data and outrage. But I mean, obviously, that's an optimistic take on it. But I think that there's no alternative, because if you get into this perpetual cycle of outrage and quick fire reaction, then I think it benefits the right ultimately.
Well, I will, as a member of the media, I will attempt to keep that in mind. William Davies, thank you for joining us. Author of Nervous States, Democracy and the Decline of Reason. Everyone should take a look at it. I think that there's quite a bit that we can learn that's very appropriate to the time that we find ourselves in. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Tucker Carlson attacking the Green New Deal, science and women all together somehow after this. So I told you a while back that the second the right switches from, you know, disingenuous attacks against the Green New Deal to seriously talking about it, I would let you know. And so, sorry, we're not there yet. But what we do have is Tucker Carlson implying that feminists are the only reason you care at all about climate change or whatever in this clip.
So what's to blame for this world-ending cataclysm? Well, a new research paper has the answer. It is, you're not going to be surprised, toxic masculinity, that's causing global warming. The paper argues that being environmentally conscious is a stereotypically feminine trait. So men, in response, assert their masculinity by deliberately destroying the environment and hogging the remote. They drive gas guzzlers, use plastic bags, they light things on fire. It's what men do. If we want to save the environment, we have to suppress men. It's like World War II, sort of.
And people say that the right can't do comedy.
Oh my God. And thank you, Tucker Carlson, walking clump of manhood. Giant, hairy, testicle, incarnate Tucker Carlson.
So
for saying all of this. Because when you think of dude, when you think of man, you think of a guy with floppy Cape Cod hair and pleated slacks going, I don't understand this. Get it.
So you're joking, but like, you know that he really does think that he's nailed.
No, he's afraid that he is seen by people the way he looks at Chris Hayes, and that's why he lashes out at, guess who? Chris Hayes.
Yeah. He's a human bow tie. Anyway, so look, the actual study, what was it saying? It's saying that there are products basically that appeal to people who care about the environment. And environmentalism has been portrayed by people like Tucker Carlson as being a feminine sort of thing. And so men might be less likely to purchase those products. That's what it says. It does not say that climate change is responsible for this. It doesn't say that we need to oppress men. But that didn't stop him from going on and making a bold statement like this.
I mean, how did we wind up with a country in which feminists do science? I mean, isn't that, you're sort of bound to get a study like this, right?
How did feminists get to do science? Well, AOC, who we also talked about that segment, answered it saying, democracy and civil rights is how we got a country where feminists do science. Also note how he's drumming up fear around women's rights to create suspicion around climate change policy tells you a lot. And for him, it's a low risk strategy because there are no women watching his show for him to offend.
Science embraces certain aspects of feminism, as in like, I'm giving equal credence to ideas regardless of whether they came from men or women.
Yeah. Yeah, and the people who put that study together, are they hardcore feminists? I don't know. Do you actually disagree with their finding? Would you like to fund a counter study to see if it's not? It's just Tucker, so frustrating because the stakes are so high.
Tucker has cultivated a list of like catchphrases that he knows in his audience's mind are winners if he repeats. Mm. So he finds other stories and tries to get to those catchphrases as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
One is toxic masculinity, the other is AOC.
Exactly, yeah. And he knows that his audience is really scared that they're going to look like Chris Hayes and not be a man or something. Or they're afraid that, like, it's just male insecurity. And again, he doesn't have a lot of talents, but he does know how to play on male insecurity. Almost like he's lived with it his whole life. Anyway, thank you everybody for joining us this week on the Damage Report. Brett, thank you for helping us close out the week. Always good to have you here. To everybody who hasn't yet left a review on the podcast, do it. I want to read some new ones. And we'll be doing that next week. So thank you again. We'll see you on Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.